So now back at Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, recorded last December, here is the Harlem Quartet in a complete performance of the string quartet in F major, Opus 135 by Beethoven.
Thank you. Thank you.
String Quartet in F Major, Opus 135 by Beethoven, performed here by the Harlem Quartet, Ilmar Gavilan and Melissa White, violin, Jaime Amador, viola, and Felix Umansky, cello. Rob will now return to the stage, and Mr. Kaplow and the members of the quartet will engage the audience at Merkin Concert Hall at Kauffman Music Center, this recorded back in December, in an informal and fun Q&A.
All right, chance of a lifetime. Would you like to hear the canon that this piece was actually based on? All right. It only takes 30 seconds. Have we got our recording ready back there? Amazingly enough, I thought, how can we ever play this for you? And then I went on YouTube thinking there's no way this exotic canon would ever be there. There were four versions on YouTube of Es muss sein canon. So let's see. This is, it's about 30 seconds long. You got it?
Es muss sein. Es muss sein. Es muss sein, es muss sein, dein, 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 es muss sein, 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 es muss sein.
I tried to get them to sing it, but they thought that that would be actually better. All right, chance of a lifetime. Who has a question for anyone on stage? Yes, go ahead, sure.
Who was the intended audience for this piece?
Great, his question was, who was the intended audience for this piece? Anyone want to take that? Or I'll always take anything, but feel free to jump in. You know, it's interesting. In many ways, the whole issue of who is the intended audience for Beethoven changes over the course of his career. At the beginning, this music was really written just for people to play. The real audience was actually performers themselves. There were no professional quartets when Beethoven started writing quartets in 1800. It was just something you did at home, and there were no professional quartet concerts. Over the course of his career, professional professional quartets got formed, particularly, in fact, the Schuppanzigh Quartet, to play Beethoven's quartets. And gradually, over the course of his career, there actually start to be quartet concerts. And so many people say that the first ones were written to be played at home for the performers themselves. By the middle period, they were written to be played for audiences. And in the end, they were written to be played only for Beethoven himself and future generations. So, interestingly enough, these pieces were just completely misunderstood. People thought he had just, it was the result of deafness. He had no idea what he was writing. In fact, I was just reading, and I may have the exact number wrong, but in the 25 years after his death in Vienna, there were only 7 performances of any of the late quartets in 25 years after his death. People just thought this was crazy music. So he wrote it really, according to those people, for himself and for some future audience that could only imagine would possibly understand it. Anyone else? Yes, go ahead, for anyone here.
You interpret the last movement as like a parody, I guess? Mm-hmm. So what is the question that is difficult to resolve?
He said, I interpret the movement as the last movement as a parody, and he wants to know what is the question. First of all, I should turn it to the quartet since they're the one who actually played it and not me. Your thoughts first.
The previous question, we're so glad you took it, so maybe we should take this one too.
Well, first of all, do you think of it as a parody or do you think of it serious? Like when you play at the very beginning, are you committed to this melodrama or do you think that it's sort of mocking the melodrama itself?
Well, as the violist and the cello that would start playing that motif in a minor and very menacing way, I don't think you feel like it's going to be a parody or a joke. You know, it feels like it's going to be something very somber, something very dark.
Right.
So once he actually introduced the happy thought, you know, it reminds me what I was telling Felix, you know, it's Christmas right now. You know, there's something about that motif, it feels very happy, very, right. You know, so I don't think it's a joke. It's something right. Like sometimes we take things very seriously. So sometimes to resolve those things, you need to take your step away and try to think very simplistic about it. So.
Yeah. Also, I think the question, you know, is it serious or a parody? The answer is yes. And I think that's really, the truth is it's both. You know, I think when you do the melodrama, you believe in the melodrama, and then you laugh at the melodrama, and I think that's what's so wonderful about it. It sort of accepts both of them, and both are true.
Sorry, I even read someplace that there's a letter from him to his publisher, I guess one of his publishers, and in that letter he says something along the lines of, must it be that I must finish this quartet?
Right.
Yes, it must be.
Right. So there's no doubt that he both meant it and didn't mean it, and it was serious and it wasn't a parody. So I would say all of the above is my answer. Anyone else? Yes, sure, go ahead.
For anyone, when you're playing, do you feel the radicalness, the modernity of it, as you play this CWU?
Oh, question was, do they feel how modern it is when you're actually playing it?
Personally, I don't. I learned a lot from today's show. I think it has to do with our training. Like, for us, this is not very unusual. Yeah, that's what we do for a living. Oh, yeah, we play things that are more modern. Yeah, definitely. Bartok or countless things that are more modern. Shostakovich.
But for 50 or 60 years after this was written, everyone thought it was just bizarre music that was beyond contemporary music. So, in fact, it's a very recent phenomenon that student quartets play the late quartets of Beethoven. It was really only recently that this music became accepted. In the same sense, you know, that one time Rite of Spring was something that orchestras, I mean, there were 50-something rehearsals for the first performance. Now student orchestras play the Rite of Spring, you know, as if it's absolutely nothing. So now I think this music has become accepted, but it was certainly not then. Yes.
You yourself, do you still feel what Stravinsky said?
Yeah, well, like, for example, when you go to that middle part of that scherzo and they go, and they're playing that 40, to me, that just sounds as wild to me as if it were written yesterday. So I definitely do feel like that. Yeah, and also when they play those ridiculously awkward leaps on the violin, I mean, he makes it sound a little easier than it should, you know. But, I mean, that music just sounds chaotic to me, and particularly when you get to the middle of that, that scherzo movement sounds bizarre to me, yes.
Oh, don't get me wrong, we still think it's hard, like, to execute these things. No, I'm speaking for everyone, you know, even when it sounds simple, that's even harder because it has to be really in tune and really together and all of that. But your question was more like, do we hear this and perceive it as modern? And probably not too much. But in terms of executing, it's probably as hard as ever, like before.
Yeah. Oh,
it didn't get any easier with time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you weren't the only ones who had trouble going. Yeah, that's right. Yes, back there. Sure, go ahead.
I always thought
Her question was, she said that she thought normally that the second movement was supposed to be the slow movement, then the third movement was supposed to be the minuet. Beethoven begins to radically experiment with every possible order. And in fact, the most extreme version in the late quartets is a C-sharp minor quartet, in which there are really no individual movements, and all the movements go one into the other, and there's six uninterrupted movements. So Beethoven begins to experiment with every possible ordering of the movement, and basically often to try to create the maximum possible contrast. So though you're right that in quote-unquote traditional, you know, classical period music, like when we go to Haydn, and one of the great things about our next program is that is sort of the essence of what classical period music and symphonies were all about. So that's why it's such a good piece to take apart. You know, in a Haydn symphony, there definitely is a kind of a regular order that usually happens. By the time you get to late Beethoven, the idea of regular anything is long gone. There's no fixed order, there's no anything, and everything in the world that you could imagine happens. And in those late quartets, there's not one that has a traditional kind of four-movement plan like that. Yes?
When Mozart uses the plucking, the
pizzicato.
Is he using that above the, does he anchor that to the music, or what's his purpose? Does he use that as a above the music, or is it incorporated?
Great question. He wants to know when composers use pizzicato, what's the purpose of using that? Well, I'm going to turn that to you since there's so many different answers to that.
Sure. Well, I think pizzicato can be used for many different things, but it's a textural change. And so I think after when Beethoven uses it, for instance, at the end of the last movement, I think it kind of takes you to another world that we've yet to experience the entire piece. It's charming. To me, it kind of reminds me of a jewelry box a little. Then you're going to close the lid and that story's done.
Uh-huh. It can produce many different textures. I mean, play a Bartok pizz. You know, Bartok has a particularly aggressive, you know, and asked to play these aggressive kinds of pizzas as well. So I think they're happening. Do you guys play the beginning of the Ravel pizzicato movement, you know, by heart?
We play another one that we have more in our fingers now. With
WC.
Music, we can do that one.
Okay.
We'll send you a bill later, Robert. That's
it's extra for this. Don't get me started. That's one of my favorite What Makes a Great programs. Okay, maybe one or two more. I know you've been here for a long time. Anyone up there? I always forget up there. Anyone upstairs? Yes, up there. Go ahead. Yes.
We keep talking about all the composers. I just want to acknowledge your charm, enthusiasm, and brilliance, which is considerable.
Thank you.
We're not related. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I want to say how wonderful it is to hear the Haydn Quartet again this year, because they were so memorable last year. So welcome back, and tell us what you've been doing in the intervening year.
Great. She said she was wanted to say how great it was to have the Haydn Quartet back this year, since we did a program with them last year on Dvorak, and they want to know what they've been doing in between. So just start on September 1. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, that's very kind. Thank you very much. We're happy to be back. Thanks, Rob, for having us. Let's see. A lot's happened since then. We've performed all around the States, and we actually just started as the resident quartet at the Royal College of Music in London. And so now we go across the pond.
A short subway ride away.
Exactly. And we get to work with the students over there, which is a great time. So we just returned a week ago, and then we'll be back to London in January.
Anyone else? One or two more, and we'll go home. Go ahead.
Question about the sound of the cello, because sometimes it's always sound great, but sometimes it sounds more resonant, sometimes thinner. And if you can talk about why that is.
You want to know about this particular cello?
Or part of the music, I'm not sure.
Go ahead.
Let's see, how do I answer? Do you remember what spot specifically? There are definitely times where it's intentional. Hopefully, it never happened unintentionally. For me, it all depends on basically who I am in the texture, or texturally speaking. And sometimes, based on, you know, what I think the answer to that may be. I might use the various tools where I'm putting the bow on the string and what string I'm actually using to play said note or left hand pressure to try to achieve that. So sometimes I want to play with, you know, a sound that hugs the entire ensemble, but without being overpowering. And yeah, it's actually a lot of fun. I could go on and on about that, but yeah, hopefully it was never unintentional when I did that.
All right, who has the last question of the night, who's going to round everything up with one final meaningful, the meaning of the universe is no pressure. Okay, your last one, go ahead. How much did the string quartet influence early 20th century music? You guys can speak to that. How much did string quartet influence early 20th century music?
You mean the nature of the genre of the string quartet? And the short answer, I think, would be a lot. I think since the beginning of the string quartet as a genre, composers have sort of turned to it and returned to it. I think as an outlet for their most intimate thoughts. I think of it almost like you're reading a diary or taking a page or a couple of pages of a composer's diary and being able to see or hear what they might have been experiencing in the world around them, personally speaking, professionally speaking. And I think that's what composers turn to time and time again. But in the early 20th century music, of course, there was so much that was going on in the world in the early 20th century. So composers were trying to experiment, and you could hear that. You could imagine what must have been going on outside the walls that they were composing in.
Yeah, I mean, a string quartet has always been a kind of a test for a composer because there's nowhere to hide. You know, each of the four parts have to be really independent. And so in a way, it's one of the hardest mediums. And I feel like, you know, there are certain things that have always been tests for composers. Fugue has always been a test for composers. And for generation after generation, composers have felt like, I have to take the test of fugue. And another one is string quartet because it's so transparent and hard to do. So I think every generation has reinvented the string quartet. You know, in the early 20th century, it was Bartok was the most significant one in his six quartets who reinvented what a quartet could do. But still up to this day, the Kronos Quartet, who actually partners with the Face of the Music group here, actually at the Kaufman Center as well, is reinventing up to this very day what a string quartet is. So I think one of the wonderful things is now you can go back as far as Haydn, and these same four instruments often played with instruments that still existed in Haydn's day, because many quartets are actually using those old ones, is still being reinvented each day. Maybe I could actually finish the night this way. There's a wonderful quote from Stravinsky. I don't think I have it word by word, but he says, think of tradition as not as something that's in the past, but it's a heritage, an heirloom that has to get passed on from each generation, but each generation first has to make that tradition bear fruit. And I would say that that's really what a string quartet is. It's this tradition that's been passed on since the days of Haydn, but each generation has reinvented how it works together, what kind of musical language it can speak, and they've passed it on to the next generation, who then reinvents it and passes it on to their descendants. And so it's still being reinvented to this day. I'm sure you have pieces commissioned to you that you're playing right now, and that's the wonderful thing. So you can sit here on the stage and see these very four instruments that could play a Haydn string quartet from the 1700s, or the Kronos Quartet playing it today, and each generation is reinventing it, making it bear fruit, and passing it on to its descendants. And on that note, I'd like to really thank this fantastic quartet. Take a bow.
Rob Capello and the Harlem Quartet in this What Makes It Great episode focusing on the final string quartet of Beethoven, the Quartet in F Major, Opus 135, recorded last December at Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan, the home of What Makes It Great. Few people we wish to thank for making these broadcasts possible. Of course, Rob Capello, also Lydia Kontos, Executive Director of Kauffman Music Center, Emily Krell, Merkin Concert Hall Producer and Managing Director, and Joan Jastrzebski, Communications Director. Our recording engineer for this program was Bill Moss. You can find out what's happening at Merkin Concert Hall and the Kauffman Music Center by going to their website, Kauffman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N, kauffmanmusiccenter.org. What Makes It Great is made possible in part through the sponsorship of David and Phyllis, because classical music is essential, and also Dragon Thistle Studio in Solbury, Bucks County, Pennsylvania. The next What Makes It Great will feature the final symphony of Franz Joseph Haydn, the Symphony No. 104, the London, and will come your way Friday evening, March 9th. For Rob Capello, the Harlem Quartet, I'm David Osberg. Thanks for being with us for this episode of What Makes It Great, which is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.